Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, what's up, everyone? We have got a special full-length episode for you today on the weekend edition of the Real Vision Daily Briefing. Amazing conversation between the president and CEO of Rule Investment Media, Rick Rule, and legendary entrepreneur and the chairman of Equinox Gold, Ross Beaty, discussing the difficulty that comes with raising capital for small businesses, the willingness to adapt when things don't go right, and so much more. So sit back and enjoy this one.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Rick Rule, investor and speculator for Real Vision. I'm delighted to bring this series to Real Vision viewers. The idea here being to emulate the Living Legends part of my old conferences. In Living Legends, I interviewed serially successful natural resource entrepreneurs, people who had built multi-billion dollar public companies from standing starts. The purpose wasn't merely to be congratulatory to these people in terms of their success, but rather to profile how they built these companies, what lessons they learned in building these companies, how the lessons that they learned in building these companies made them successful investors rather than merely entrepreneurs in their own right. But most importantly, how the lessons that they learned can make you a better investor inside of the natural resource space and outside of the natural resource space. I'd like to kick off this series by interviewing a man who is at least figuratively an old friend of mine, Ross Beaty. He informed me that we've done business together for 36 years, which is a very long time. And Ross has been, during that period of time, an immensely successful entrepreneur, also an immensely successful private investor. On top of that, he's parlayed that success into becoming a very influential philanthropist. And on top of all that, he is a good friend. I like to say as an investor that I segregate between entrepreneurs that I backed. And one way that I segregate is between those who have made me look smart, like Ross, and those who have made me look stupid, who I may interview in another interview series later, which will be somewhat less flattering. Ladies and gentlemen, you're in for a real treat. Ross, welcome to the process. I'm delighted to have you with me.
Thank you very much, Rick. I look forward to the conversation today and hope I don't disappoint you or your subscribers, your listeners.
Let's put this in context for the listeners first, Ross. I'd like you to describe your education and your early career, how you chose that education, and what your first career paths were and how you chose those.
Sure. Well, I mean, I just am a born entrepreneur. I'm very impatient, selfish, greedy, all those sort of things that make people want to start their own companies and push hard and do well. I'm very self-motivated and you know, my first, really during all the 70s, I was a student. I was a great learning devotee. I just wanted to learn everything I could about everything. And I took a couple degrees in geology. I did a degree in law because it was completely different than geology. I traveled the world for two full years of that 10-year period. And you know, there's nothing like traveling in the world and there's nothing like working in the world to understand how it works. And the history and geography, it very much has defined my love of history and geography has defined very much, I think, my success to a large degree and my enjoyment of learning things and learning about people. So I finished all that in 1980. I started my very first company then, BD Geological, a small contract geology company. Did that for 4 or 5 years. And then I got into the public company arena because I was in Vancouver. And at that time, the Vancouver Stock Exchange, as you well know, was a small exchange. You could raise a small amount of money very cheaply, and so I did. And you were actually in that company, one of the seed investors, as I recall. And then really that was a gold mining company mainly in the USA and Canada. We made all kinds of mistakes, but ultimately we found a gold mine and sold that for a pretty good price after 9 years to a large U.S. mining company. And I was able to start again. And I started another company, which was going to be a big silver mining company, and another little junior company in a gold deposit in Bolivia. And then really the silver company has become one of the world's largest silver producers. It's a very large company now. It has about 11,000 employees, and it's operating in six countries in the world. Big gold producer, big silver producer, second biggest in the world. And I guess just along the way to the present time, I've had 15 public companies, founded 15 public companies, all in the resource space except for one, which all in the mineral resource space except one, which became a quite a large renewable energy company. I wanted to build something green and clean and do something a little different, but still in the resource development space. And so I tried my hand at power development, and it was I would say it was a reasonable success, but not a home run. But we ultimately built quite a big company, and it's still there today. It's a large producer of clean energy. And then my last company is named after my first one, Equinox Gold. It's what I'm working on mostly right now, trying to build a world-class gold mining company, and so far so good. So it's been a great career. Many commodities, many different companies, several different teams of people as well. The operating teams have been all different, and then the exploration development teams have been different. But you know, I've had a lot of luck, and I really feel that's my biggest reason for success. I've been a very lucky guy in discovery and timing and all kinds of things. So it's been a great journey and a lot of fun. Primarily, my career has been that as a developer. In other words, I've been a company builder. Most of my energy and effort and actually investment success has been as a company builder. But I did segue for a few years into the world of just investing. When I was doing my clean energy company, I was just an investor in natural resource companies. And actually, that turned out to be pretty successful, too. So it's been a great journey, a lot of fun. I'm definitely in the end game of my career. This is my last company right now. I'm not a spring chicken anymore, and you know, it's time for me to do a few other things. I'm very heavily involved in philanthropy, and that's kind of my big love right now, environmental philanthropy. So that's a nutshell of my career.
That's a great overview, and so now we're going to take it apart part by part. I'm going to begin with a personal comment on the last part, which is where you suggest that you're in the sunset of your career. I've watched you fail retirement twice now, Ross, and I'm highly confident that while you were retired in June, July, August, and September, which is to say during the summer, that when your ability to ski when your ability to kayak and bicycle wanes, that your natural curiosity will overcome you. And I suspect that you'll fail retirement for the third time. But that's speculation on my part. Let's unpack some of the earlier stuff that you've done. You've suggested, first of all, that you were lucky. You were a scientist before you were a businessman. And the consequence of you being a scientist is that you know that luck favors the trained observer. What has always interested me about you. I mean, I've known a lot of smart guys. You're a smart guy. But your confidence. We have a young guy coming out with a degree, I guess, in geological engineering with a law degree on top of it. And he decides somehow that he has enough experience to become a geological consultant with no experience whatsoever. How on earth? And I remember you talked me out of money as a consequence of talking John Brown, who I respected, out of money. Out of curiosity, where did the confidence come from to go to some place like Placer Dome with an army of geoscientists and explain to them that you had something of value when you were a freshly minted geologist with a law degree and no articles? I mean, how did you do that?
I mean, it's just part of, I think, being a successful entrepreneur, Rick. You can spin stories and, you know, I mean, I was a reasonable geologist, but not a fabulous one. And I love field work. I love working in the bush. I love working in nature. But, you know, I could sell stock and I could sell stories and I could dream up ideas and sell them. I was a good salesman. That's kind of where that is. And I was a self-starter. I didn't wait for the phone to ring. I picked up the phone and made the calls. And that's really what defined getting out there and getting those deals. And, you know, I failed so many times in that first company. You know, reviewed way over 100 deposits before we made our big discovery down in Nevada. Probably hundreds and hundreds. And so, you know, you've got to be able to, you know, in this game, it's such high risk. You cannot put all your eggs in one basket. You've got to have many, many eggs in many, many baskets. And if you have enough, and if you get that extra little bit of luck, which is what you need. Now, it's true, you make your luck, and you can't win a lottery unless you buy a whole bunch of tickets. But, you know, you've got to get lucky. And if you do, then after that, it's relatively easy. So a gift of the gab and an ability to part people from their money, you've included in that. As long as you then spend it where you say you're going to spend it, and every so often it works out, people will do it. People will give you more money, and they'll bet you, they'll bank on you again. And that's kind of how my career has been. The first one was the toughest. After that, you make people money, they give it to you again.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi: People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
So you started your public company career, if my memory serves me well, with a private vehicle, Alma, which was conceptual.
Very much.
Gold hosted and mercury deposits in the Coast Range.
Yeah.
Probably a copycat of McLaughlin or something like that.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
morphed into Equinox. So your initial career, oddly, was in the very, very, very riskiest part of the resource business, which is to say exploration. How did you choose, as an example, the prospect generator financing model? At your point in time, most people who were starting companies in Vancouver found a property. They spun a story around it like, you know, 100 years ago, had the mule not died, the prospector would have been a billionaire. And they did sole risk exploration for their own account on that project. How did you choose prospect generation, and how did you build Equinox? And for that matter, why did you choose, when you had nothing to lose, I guess, the riskiest part of the value creation chain in resources?
Well, Rick, you know, don't forget, in 1983 or 84, when we got that company going, you know, I was 32 years old. I had absolutely no money. I raised a tiny bit of money. But, you know, money was hard to come by. So you go into the cheapest part of the business where you don't have to buy things. You stake claims and you then cross your fingers and hope you get lucky and you have ideas. And so, for example, that mercury gold idea, we had all these properties that we staked claims on. They had lots of mercury, but none of them ever had any gold. Now, we didn't find a single speck of gold in any of those properties. And yet we used those properties to go public. And once we had a public company, then I was doing some work on a contract basis in West Africa, in Sierra Leone and Liberia, where there's a lot of gold. And I went there and I thought, well, maybe this, you know, Liberia is wide open. Nobody's been there for, you know, ever really looking for modern technology, looking for gold. So I thought, well, let's take that first little company that we took public over to Liberia. And so I had a really good property there. I bought a drill in Vancouver, hired a driller, shipped everything over there. And of course, the next thing that happened, there was a revolution in Liberia, and people starting to get their hands chopped off and heads chopped off, and it was a disaster. So we had to flee. And that was the end of that episode. And then I spent 3 years looking for platinum in Canada unsuccessfully. We looked for lithium. We had a deal with Teck looking for lithium in the Great Basin of the U.S. And we found lots of lithium, but this was in the mid-80s when it wasn't worth very much. So that was the end of that. So I had all these, failed things that were failed projects, but we kept going. And I kind of had this philosophy that if you keep changing the story, nobody will tell you you're worthless. You always give that sort of, okay, that wasn't a failure, that wasn't a success, that deal, but we've got this other deal and it looks really good. And I spun a little story around it and raised a little bit more money. And then bingo, after 3 years or so of doing this, we finally found this deposit in Nevada that was that turned out to be a really, really high grade gold mine. So, we eventually got lucky, but it was certainly not until we'd had a lot of failures. But we just kept picking ourselves up, dusting ourselves off, and moving on. And I had loyal investors who said, as long as you spend your money the way you say you're going to spend it, even if you have failure, which is a kind of a preconceived likelihood in this high-risk business, we'll bet on your next deal. And sure enough, finally, we did okay. And ultimately, the company was sold at an all-time high. So every single investor would have made money in the company if they'd kept it to the end. So it was kind of it ended well, but there were a lot of, a lot of frustrations and disappointments along the way.
I might say that this first experience with Ross Beaty, I believe I was involved in for 8 years. So we worked the better part of a decade to be overnight successes. Yeah. The takeaway for this first discussion in the interview for viewers, I would suspect, is the real attributes of your first success were positiveness, which is to say that when your exploration efforts failed, you didn't quit, you kept going. And something that's related to positiveness, which is tenacity. Would you agree with that, that your success, in addition to your intelligence and your ability to work hard, had to do with incurable optimism and incredible tenacity? Is that a fairly accurate summation?
That is accurate, but there was one extra ingredient, and that is that when we took Equinox public in 1985, we raised the grand total of $145,000, and the market wasn't very good then, so I ended up having to raise all the money myself, and I raised it through friends and family, and I had my mother as a seed investor, not a seed investor, she bought the IPO when we took Equinox public, and so believe me, when you have your mother as a shareholder, and every time you go over for Sunday night dinner, she's saying, "Well, how's Equinox, or what was the name of that company I invested in? How's it doing?" And you want to make her more than she invested. You do not want to lose your mother money. So that was another ingredient that I think was a contributing factor to working hard and making the company work out in the end. But it's also true, it's kind of like this is a high risk game. It's not unlike gambling. You have to just keep at it, and gambler's ruin is also a truism in this business. If you keep getting unlucky with attempts to find gold mines, you will go bankrupt, you will go out of business, and you just have to have that little extra ingredient of luck. And that's luck in not just discovery, but it's also luck in timing, because in this business, it's a very, very cyclical world. The tide comes in, the tide goes out. And, you have to kind of be in the right place at the right time as well, because when the tide comes in, it's very easy to raise money. When the tide goes out, it's very difficult. And you've got to be able to work in both of those environments if you're going to be successful.
Ross, believe me, we're going to talk about timing and cyclicality later in this interview. I noticed that you referred to your mother. Little did you know I was a much greater risk than your mother. I was young, strong, mean, and aggressive. I'm glad that your concern over your mother saved you from my wrath.
You didn't have as big a capacity to terrify me as she did, believe me.
So now we've lurched from one mistake to another through Equinox, and through some serendipity, discovered a mine which we sold to Hecla. I remember that at that point in time. And expecting a phone call from you, I had to wait, 7 or 8 hours probably. And you said, we're going in the silver business.
Yeah.
So I want to know why you made what I regard as the correct decision to go into the silver business when the industry-wide cash cost of producing silver exceeded the selling price for silver. In other words, what gave you the courage to build a silver company when all of the silver companies out there like Hecla were buying gold deposits to stay alive? Tell me about the intellectual formulation of Pan American Silver.
Sure. It's pretty simple, Rick. You were right that Hecla bought my first company, and it was a share exchange. So I had to look at what was inside Hecla, and Hecla had three business areas. One was gold mining, one was silver mining, and one was industrial minerals. And they had the clay deposit. They were mining clay. And in fact, they were trading absolutely in correlation with the silver price because they had been known as a big U.S. silver name. So they were known as a silver company, trading as a silver price, but they really weren't anymore a silver company. Silver was less than 10% of their revenues. I looked then at Coeur d'Alene and Sunshine Mining and both of those other companies, which were the only big silver names in 1994, both of them had big problems. Also, Coeur tended to be more of a gold company than a silver company. Sunshine was heading to bankruptcy, which ultimately it ended up in. And I just thought to myself, if investors are buying those companies as silver names, then they must have no choice. So if I create another choice for them, a real company that has real silver assets and absolutely focus, an absolute, you know, crystal clear laser vision focus on building itself as the world's best silver equity, the best silver stock that would be a better proxy for investment in silver than silver bullion, I would succeed if I could do that. And so we set out our mission from day one when we had a shell company with no assets, no cash, no people, just an idea. We took some of the people from Equinox and we said, we are going to build the world's biggest silver mining company from scratch. And guess what? That just simply the vision was enough to bring a whole bunch of mostly U.S. investors into the company who got the stock price up to the point that I could raise some money at it. And then we used that money to buy silver assets all over the place, silver mines, silver deposits, staying focused on silver. And ultimately, you know, 27 years later, or actually it was probably about 20 years later, Pan American did become the world's second largest silver mining company, which it remains today, second largest primary silver mining company. And that for me has been my biggest business success because it's one that not only is it the biggest company, it's the one that really has proven the value of staying laser focused on a simple story, executing it well, and ultimately being right that if you do execute these things well, investors will come, support you, and you can all build a very successful business together that today is a big dividend producer and a real nice generator of wealth for a lot of people.
So that the listeners understand the magnitude of this success, if my memory serves me well, your first public financing, which I had the good fortune to participate in, was at 50 cents. And you talk about the ensuing 29 years. But the truth is that 6 years after that 50-cent financing, if my memory serves me well, the stock was over $40 bid.
Not quite 10 years later, but it hit almost $50 bid in the, I think it hit $50 about 2007, or maybe it was the 2011 run. There were those two big bull runs there. In any case, it did pretty well. Yeah,
it was truly successful. One of the things that really interested me in Pan American, a lesson that you employed then that you've employed since too, was your intuitive understanding that you had to have scale,
right?
That you had to have mass. You were willing to buy lower quality projects at the beginning of the exercise to build mass. And then you did a great job of using that mass to increase your trading liquidity, lower your cost of capital, buying higher quality projects, and disposing of, when appropriate, the lower quality prospects. So if you could talk something about the advantages of scale, the amalgamation process, and the discipline that needs to be employed in the amalgamation strategy to build a company like Pan American from a standing start?
Sure. Well, I think, we did it with Pan American. We did it with the renewable energy company, Altera Power. We have done it with Equinox Gold in recent years. Equinox just started at the beginning of 2018. So it's just not even 4 years old now, but we're one of the world's, I guess, top 20 gold producers already. It's so super important to build scale, and it's more important today than ever, Rick. I would say it's way, way more important today than it was even in the 90s. And that's because the investment market has changed over the years. So scale has always been a good idea. It's particularly good today because there's a lot of investors who simply will not buy the small companies. They only want to buy through ETFs and other forms of, non-value-oriented investment funds. And so you can't get into those pools of capital unless you're large. So that's one reason. Number two, it's a much more expensive game today to build a public company in the resource business. So if you have small production or a small vision or a small project, you're always going to be burdened with a very high administrative burden to pay for all the regulatory costs, the accounting costs, the legal costs, all those overhead costs that a company has to pay today. And then you have the bit of, in this game, it's a very risky business. So the larger you are, the lower risk you have per se. The more you have an offset from problems in either a country or a project. If you have five projects in five countries, one country might go topsy, which happens all the time these days, and you're still going to be okay because the other four countries are going to kind of buffer that high-risk problem, say, you've got. Or if you have five deposits, you have one in a place where you might have environmental or social or crazy problems, and the other four are going to buffer that. And I've certainly experienced that in the last few years with my gold company. And so scale is important. It means there's a lot more money that goes to investors as opposed to third parties through services and overheads. It means you have larger pools of capital. You have a lower risk profile. It's just a better business strategy, I think, today than it's ever been. And so we're going big. And, the bigger you are, the larger the pools of capital that are available for investment. And I think everybody wins in that sense. You have better multiples. Typically, you have much better multiples. The bigger you are, the more of a dividend producer you might be, or more of a earnings machine you might be. It's just good business today more than it's ever been.
Ross, I would suggest that it's going to become even more important given now the market's accessibility throughout the market financings, the ability particularly for U.S. listed companies to access the volume on the New York Stock Exchange and do financings almost on an as-needed basis, the ability to monetize volume. Yeah. Stock market volume suggests that the advantages of scale, particularly when combined with a U.S. listing, are increasingly important in building
all
companies.
True.
Any comment on that? Okay.
All true. Just more reasons to build scale.
I want to get away from scale a little bit to focus on discipline, because I think one of the lessons in Pan American that will be useful to our listeners was your discipline in general and administrative expense. We used to joke, Ross, that you threw around nickels as though they were manhole covers, and that thriftiness was meant as a compliment. I won't mention the competitor, but we published years ago, we meaning me, a study comparing you with a mid-sized gold company, and your general and administrative expense was a quarter of theirs. Yeah. They were a multi-system operator. If you could talk to the importance of discipline and where investors might look to see that discipline reflected, and how important when you're making third-party investments now, the ratio between disciplines to AU, G&A to AUM or G&A to EBIT, how important that is to you?
Well, I've always felt that my company's money is investors' money. It's the shareholders' money. It wasn't my money. And so, it was just an obligation for me to be as frugal as I possibly could with it and spend it, as much as possible where it was going to have the best value, which is in the ground, drilling holes, doing field work, as opposed to places that didn't create wealth at all. They dissipated wealth, which is overhead. And, you know, today it's a different world. I mean, you know, I always used to pay our team through trying to pay at the lower quartile or lower half, certainly, of general pay scales, but make the job happy and make it fun and make it successful. And so people weren't just working for money. They were working in an environment that was a lot of fun and very successful. It's more difficult today. It's much more difficult today because you have all of these, you know, these, and I, this is probably going to be a rant, you know, these compensation committees who are simply burdened by the laws and the regulations and the policies that now exist to hire third party consultants who tell them how much they're supposed to pay the CEO and the COO and all the senior teams. And it's an inexorable process of leading to higher and higher and higher salaries and compensation levels, higher bonuses, because they're always trying to get to the P50 level of compensation. And if somebody is paid below the 50% average, they bring them up to that, which brings everybody up. And over time, that causes higher and higher and higher salaries. And it's got completely ridiculous today. So it's a big problem in the whole industry where compensation levels today are basically out of control. And I think that's true in almost every public company, but certainly in the resource sector, it's true. So today I can't do what I used to be able to do, Rick, where really we could screw down costs as much as possible and pay people in having fun as opposed to just a bunch of money. Now we have to kind of do both. And it's harder to have that low overhead profile that we used to have. But certainly everywhere possible, you know, to have a reputation for being frugal is something I wore very proudly on my sleeve.
I think the fact that you care, Ross, is very indicative. And the next thing I want to talk about in the context of Pan American Silver is your own presence and the importance in growing big public companies of adult supervision. I look at the success of Pan American Silver relative to other silver companies, and I note that you have continued as chairman, then non-executive chairman, but you've always been in place. Yeah. I believe personally that adult supervision, which is to say some living human being, not a committee, involved who is ego involved and has a large stake, is one of the most important ingredients that a third party investor can avail himself or herself of. Would you agree with that, first of all? And when you are investing with third parties, how important is that leading personality, that adult supervision, in your investment decision?
Well, I think if you do an analysis of successful companies, you'll find almost always the really successful ones have some kind of champion, some sort of an individual who is who's really the leading light of the company and who's really able to direct what goes on through as much personal willpower as anything else. And, you know, if a company loses that, it drifts into more of a bureaucratic world, which is more inefficient, less productive, less successful in the end. And especially in the growth years, you know, a company has all of these phases. It has the startup, the growth, and then the kind of this status quo or steady state operation, which is always self-funded through earnings. And in that growth period in particular, you need that driver. You need that individual who can cut through all that garbage that is involved in running public companies or for that matter, any company these days, and just always be focused on the mission, always be focused on where they're trying to get to, as opposed to this god-awful process of you know, the world of public companies these days, which is so much more process-driven and less focused on wealth creation. And you've just got to be able to cut through that and go to where you want to get to and hope that you've got your timing right and your success right and hope that you actually end up pulling it off.
Value creation. So let's follow value creation. The next adventure that we want to talk about was the creation of yours that did the most to enhance my personal value, for which I am appreciative. I want to move on now to Lumina Copper. I realize that success happened concurrently with Pan American, but I think we've beat the silver business to death. Let's move on to the copper business. Explain to me how you decided to build a major copper company. and how the conception and the outcome of the Copper Company. In other words, you didn't set out to recreate Freeport. You set out to take advantage of a certain set of market conditions and a certain asset. So take us through an overview of the thought process that led to the creation of Lumina Copper. Take us through the quantum, how much money you started with and how much money you liquidated all of the parts for.
Sure.
And tell us how you caused that to occur. Briefly, of course.
Yeah, I'll try to abridge all these long. It's like a long story, but I'll try to do it quickly. So even Pan American, you know, we started Pan American when the silver price was $5 an ounce. I was confident that it was going to be over $10 in a few years and that everything we bought was going to have much greater value. Of course, 6 years later, 2000, the silver price was less than it was when we started. But then it really had a lovely run. From 2002 on, it ran all the way to $50 an ounce. So it was ultimately it ultimately worked. And so it was getting in kind of at the right time and working hard and building assets for when that happy moment came when the whole market took off. And so in 2002, kind of the same thing happened in copper. Copper, you know, was at an all-time low. 2001, 2002, copper was at an all-time low. It was about 60 cents a pound. Nobody wanted to hear the word copper. There were all kinds of deposits around that were worthless. And I decided I'd go against the grain. I'd be a contrarian and I'd buy as much copper as I could because copper is a cyclical metal. And this is a cyclical world we're in. And sure enough, to make a long story short, we acquired about 10 deposits over a couple of years. And in 2003, the market turned from a bearish market to a bullish market for copper. Copper rose. And by 2014, I think we'd invested $200 million in what turned out to be six different copper companies that all came out of the first Lumina Copper. And we sold all six of those companies for about $2 billion. So it was a real nice gain, and we all made out like bandits.
The supposition in resource-based business is, of course, that you have an entrepreneur who comes with a good story, but ultimately he or she makes their money by looting widows and orphans. That isn't what you did. You bought copper deposits from the biggest copper companies in the world. And later in the cycle, you sold copper deposits to the bigger copper companies in the world. How is it that Ross Beaty became a pawnbroker to the copper industry? What is it that you knew about copper or knew about cycles that the biggest mining companies in the world, or at least the bureaucrats who ran them, didn't understand?
I mean, I don't know, Rick. A 2-year-old could have looked at the copper price chart from 1945 to 2002, and just seen a beautiful series of sine waves with increasing amplitude. And we were right at the very bottom. In fact, we were at an all-time low in real terms. So, I mean, how clever was it, a strategy to say that the copper price is going to go up again? I mean, it was like so simple a concept, and yet at that time nobody wanted to hear the word copper. And this is the world we're in. People are short-term investors. They don't look at the forest; they see the trees. They get buried in the trees. The same thing's happening today with gold. It's just unbelievable how people are getting kidded by this noise, this short-term noise that's going on. That means they don't look at the big picture and realize that, you know, we're in a very, very bullish environment for gold. It was exactly the same in 2002 with copper. So I was able to buy these copper deposits for nothing. And ultimately, you know, they all became really, really worthwhile. In fact, some of them are huge mines right now, one in particular in Chile. So I don't know what it is. It staggers me how people don't somehow look around and get away from the day-to-day stuff they're doing and think long-term and understand how the world works and how cycles work and how industrialization in China is more important actually than what's going on in the U.S. and from the standpoint of commodity demand. But they just don't. They just don't. They're too focused on their own little worlds.
So we're back to timeliness and tenacity, aren't we, Ross?
It
occurs to me, looking back at the success that I've enjoyed investing in you and your companies, that while the quantum of the success was large, several 10-baggers, the duration was, in every case, the shortest was probably 5 years, much more commonly 7 or 8. And when I look back, each company, I think, that I've been invested in with you fell by 50% or more, at least twice during the period of time that I've owned them. And I really want the people listening to this interview to come away with the sense that the search for a 10-bagger that doesn't happen over a long weekend. And it doesn't happen without substantial volatility. And if you don't have the courage of your conviction, both in times with both in terms of duration and dimension, that you won't enjoy the type of success that you've been able to deliver over time. After the sermon now, I want to move on from what you have done, your successes. We don't have time to talk about all of them today, but I want to talk to you now about what you're doing today, what companies you're particularly involved in. You don't have to tell me your whole portfolio, but the ones that you believe are indicative of what you're trying to accomplish, your big positions, why you entered into these businesses, what your unique business strategy is, that type of thing. Talk your book, in other words.
Well, I don't have to name names particularly.
Sure you do.
I mean, there's a bunch of names, right?
I mean the ones you're really involved in. I don't want the whole portfolio, but the ones that you think are indicative for lessons that you're involved in.
So you have to remember that I'm both today primarily a developer, but also somewhat of an investor. And I have had those two kind of hats. And they're different hats. One, you can exit as an investor. You can buy and you can sell anytime you want, and you're out. And nobody knows, nobody cares. But if you're a developer, you've got your name on the company, and I can only sell once. I can only sell if there's a happy ending, somebody buys the company, or if I decide to check out the way I've done with Pan American and actually just retire and let the company continue on as a big, big company that's going to live longer than me. Those are the two outcomes for those two sort of businesses. So as a developer, I have my clean energy company. It's called Innergex, and it's Innergex Renewable Energy. It's a big, big Canadian company now, 4,000 megawatts. It's a great company. I'm very active on the board. I'm one of the largest shareholders. That's fun. I really enjoy that business, making electricity from clean sources like wind and solar. Then I have my big gold company, Equinox Gold. I'm very involved in that because for no particularly good reason, except I just love gold and I love creating wealth. And I think the business strategy is dead easy and dead simple to build a really huge gold mining company today to make a lot of people a lot of money.
What's that dead easy strategy, Ross?
The dead easy strategy is to go big. It's to go big and be a big operator, produce a ton of gold, have huge gold reserves and resources. That's how you get leverage. So if you remember back in 2001, gold price was, $250, $300 an ounce. It went up about 350% in the bull run that followed that. Gold equities went up more than 1,000%. And that's what you want to do when you create a mining equity that has leverage to a metal, is you want to have a much, much better capital gain or a gain potential than just the value of the commodity. So we've just loaded up Equinox. We're producing 600,000 ounces today. We are going to produce 1.2 or 1.3 million ounces in a couple of years. We've got 29 million ounces of gold in reserves and resources. It's just a beautiful company. We've built it in 3.5 years, and I've got a few more years to go, and we're just going to keep going because I'm convinced the bigger you are in that business, the better it's going to be per se. So I'm very active in that company. And then I've got a couple of small gold exploration juniors that I'm active in as a sort of a developer and a very large shareholder. Lumina Gold is one. Luminex Resources is one. I'm an investor, on the other hand, in some juniors like Ero Copper, like Amerigo Copper. I've got some copper businesses like that. I've got some gold investment companies like Osino, Orca Gold. Those are some companies where I've got lumpy positions, 10 or 20% stakes, and that's what that's for me important, because if I do have a gain potential, then it's going to be material to me. So I take big positions and I stick with them. And in investment games, I'm really just looking for an exit once, and hopefully with every other shareholder. And that's happened again and again. I've had happy endings in that sense just about every year for the last 10 years with one company or another. That all those investment companies kind of look the same. They all look like they're big deposits, a lot of exploration potential, big enough that a major company is going to want to buy them, and that's generally speaking what happens. So that is the category. They're well run, smart people running them, long term focus. And just holding on to them until that happy ending comes. That's been my investment strategy there. And on the other side, you know, just trying to execute the business plan, which is usually pretty simple.
I hope the listeners replay that last soliloquy three or four times. That was the first part of the interview right there. I want to move on, Ross. I believe there are at least two kinds of wealth. One, of course, is material, and the other is what I might call honor. In addition to the fact that you've been a very successful businessman, or perhaps as a consequence of the fact that you've been a successful businessman, you have become a very committed and, I would argue, successful philanthropist. If you could talk something about the acquisition of honor as opposed to the acquisition of wealth and what it is that you're doing in philanthropy and what causes are important to you, and also how you've been a success as a philanthropist. I've learned myself that giving away money, at least for me, is substantially harder to be successful at least as I define it, than making it. Now, perhaps I've tried harder at making it, but this is not about me. This is about you. Honor and philanthropy, what you're doing.
Well, thank you for that. I'm, again, it's pretty simple. I have a pretty simple life. I don't have a huge spending quotient. My happiest times are when I'm camping and kayaking with my wife and doing things where I sleep on the ground and cook my own food. And I have five kids and they're all kind of grounded pretty well themselves. And so, you know, my wife is an anti-consumer, not a consumer at all. So we don't go through a lot of money and we have a simple life. So, and we grow all our own food in our garden, and I keep bees and chickens, and so it's for me a pretty nice life. But I've made all this money, and you know I don't want to particularly die with it all. So the result is that is to give it away, and I find it very easy to give away because I've made it pretty easily, and so easy come, easy go. But I believe like in business, if you're going to be a successful philanthropist, you want to focus. You want to have a real focus that is meaningful to you. And my personal focus is on the environment. I'm a passionate environmentalist because I love the beauty of nature. I seek best my solace, my happiness in nature all the time. And thus, I want to protect it as much as I can, look after biodiversity, stop the destruction of biodiversity that humans have wrought for so many years, and try to restore some order to the natural world. So in that box, now, no matter what you do as a philanthropist, you're going to go to heaven. You're a good person. I honor and salute you. My little box, because I like the focus, don't forget. I like to put energy into something and get good at that, know the space, and not be a shotgun where I'm giving a little bit of money to 1,000 different places. So we have a foundation called the Sitka Foundation. My daughter runs it. It's a family foundation, and we're funding about 75 different groups across Canada, some in the U.S., some internationally, all about protection of the environment and some attempt to protect biodiversity, the loss of biodiversity. So, you know, we do that in a focused way, and people know where we stand, and I can answer the phone, and if it's an ask for money for a church or a hospital or a school, I say thanks, but, you know, go somewhere else. I'm looking after the environment, and that's, I think, in a way, you could say that a more successful strategy than having a shotgun approach. But everybody is each to their own, right? I'm not telling anyone else how to give their money away. That's how I do it. And it's working well, and I'm very proud of it and happy about it. And I'm particularly happy when, you know, I can see some kind of tangible result, which I actually see when I look out from my home here in the Pacific Ocean right in front of me, and I see it improving over the years, not getting worse. And that makes me very happy, and it makes me feel there are solutions that will improve the condition of the environment. And ultimately, of course, the connection is better environment, healthier for my own kids and their kids and their kids. So it's a people thing as well. We all have to live together in a synchronized way, not a situation where one species destroys the rest of the others.
I've asked you to name some names in terms of your investment portfolio. I know that Sitka, your private foundation, doesn't raise money from third parties, but you give money to organizations that do. Do you have any names that our listeners might consider if they were interested in environmental philanthropy?
Oh, for heaven's sakes, there's tons of them. As I say, we're invested in 75 different groups right now, at least. And I do the environmental philanthropy in kind of four areas, Rick. One is just pure land conservation. And in that area, there's the Nature Conservancy of the U.S., of Canada, the Nature Trust. I'm the chair of the BC Parks Foundation. The next box is sort of scientific research, where we actually try to work on real solutions that come out of real problems that are measurable. So I'm the director and funder, big funder of the Pacific Salmon Foundation, for example, looking after salmon health. We also do education. We have a big biodiversity museum at the University of British Columbia. We're building another one in Dalhousie in Eastern Canada. And so that's great for bringing school kids into seeing the beauty of nature and how to protect it. And then public policy, you know, quite frankly, public policy is really, really helpful in addressing things like climate change and the loss of biodiversity, creating more parks, creating more protected areas. So there's all these things. There's a myriad of groups. In every one of those boxes, universities, of course, do good work. It doesn't matter where you are. You're always going to have many, many different ways to be a good environmentalist. The Sierra Club, David Suzuki Foundation in Canada, lots. I'm not talking about social justice. We're not that big on that. I'm not talking about helping Ethiopian refugees particularly. You know, that's not what we do. We do pure environmental stuff, looking after the millions of species humans rely on to be healthy.
Ross, we're just about out of time, but I really want to personally thank you for subjecting yourself to this interrogation by someone who I hope is still your old friend.
You are my old friend. You always will be, Rick, and I'm grateful for all of our years together, both as investors and as friends. I hold you in at least as high regard as you may hold me, and it has been a great journey together through all these years, Rick. I'm your greatest fan.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope those of you who have listened to this interview have both enjoyed it, but more importantly, gotten direction and insight from it. I'm going to continue this series and interview other serially successful entrepreneurs in the natural resources space for Real Vision. In the interim, any of you who would like to get in touch with me specifically about your resource investments, I'm always willing to grade individual portfolios. This is my commercial, by the way. Contact me at ruleinvestmentmedia.com. Give me your resource portfolio. I'll rank it personally, 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. Hint, you'll do well if they're Ross Beattie companies. If you care, mention charts in the comment line, and I will send you the Barron's Gold Mining Index, which is the best long-running chart on the anatomy of a gold bull market that exists. And I'll send you another chart, a 100-year commodity chart that talks about just how expensive or cheap commodities are relative to other asset classes going back 100 years. Real Vision, thank you. Ross Beattie, in particular, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen who are Real Vision subscribers, thank you too. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Real Vision subscribers can always find more amazing financial content like this at realvision.com.